This is a podcast of ABC Radio National's Late Night Live. This program can be heard broadcast or streamed from ABC Radio National. Details of frequencies, times and more downloads, abc.net.au/rn.
Verily I say unto thee, O beloved gladioli, God is good, because he's allowed me to grab the godless Francis Wheen for a bit of a chat. I talk about Francis Wheen a lot, I write about him frequently, never actually met him. Let me tell you a little bit more about who he is before I physically introduce the fellow. He's most recently the author of a highly therapeutic tome called How Mumbo Jumbo Conquered the World. This is a sequel to his equally delightful Hoo-Has and Passing Frenzies. Although he's only a young bloke, I first saw his byline in the New Statesman decades ago. Since then, he's been with The Independent on Sunday, pops up in Private Eye, columnist of the year in 1996 for Wheen's World, which was his page in The Guardian. He won the Isaac Deutscher Prize for his biography of Karl Marx, and he won the Orwell Prize for Hoo-Has. And he lives in Essex, where he plays cricket intermittently and badly. That's the only thing I have against him, playing cricket. Francis, it's great to have you on our little wireless program, because I do borrow extensively from you without attribution on a pretty regular basis, and you're even more sceptical than I am.
Well, it's a great delight to be here, and especially since you raised the word cricket. I didn't think you'd dare mention it in the circumstances, but very nice of you.
I know nothing of it, actually.
Oh, good. Well, you probably are unaware then that in the last few months something happened. No, I won't say what it was.
Please don't tell me, because
I don't want to spoil it for you, spoil the fun, the surprise, when you eventually discover what transpired in England this summer.
Now, for a bloke that was at the New Statesman when Christopher Hitchens was foreign editor and Bruce Page, the Australian, was editor, you're remarkably young.
Yes. Well, I started young. Yes, I started as an office boy on The Guardian when I was about 17 and haven't looked back, really. Then, having become the office boy, I started coming in early and leaving little articles on the features editor's desk.
Was journalism fundamentally and profoundly different when you were a 17-year-old at The Guardian than it is today?
Yes, it was, yes. I mean, I'd always wanted to be in journalism for as long as I can remember, from the age of about 7 onwards. I was setting up little newspapers at home. I mean, literally, I think my first newspaper was when I was about 7 or 8, were just in our household. And the front page splash, I remember one of them was, "Model Railway Craze Hits Wheen Household." It was all that sort of stuff.
And you checked your facts.
Editorials on the quality of Christmas presents. It's the only other readers of this were my two brothers and my parents. I'm surprised it wasn't closed down by the authorities, actually. It was a bit sniffy about some of the Christmas presents. But anyway, so I'd always wanted to be a journalist, and I was thrilled when I started on The Guardian, as I say, as a glorified office boy. But luckily, it was so small in those days, The Guardian. It was produced from 2 rooms in the Gray's Inn Road in London. So I sat in a corner of the newsroom with all these other reporters and did everything, really. Opened the press releases, dealt with readers' complaints, as well as running errands and goodness knows what else. And it was a real education in how newspapers worked. And I loved it, because it was the last days of hot metal and the old Fleet Street.
Proper papers before they became lifestyle packages.
It was, in those days, newspaper offices were very noisy. The thing I really notice nowadays is, in those days, people wrote their stories on typewriters, so there was the clatter of dozens of typewriters thundering away. And then down from the basement below, there was the thunder as the presses started to roll.
And so the linotype machines.
And there were the linotype machines. So there were all these different noises, and it added to the excitement. And now, if you go into newspaper offices, I'm sorry to say, also because they didn't afford things like fitted carpets, so even the floors were noisy when people walked on them. And now it's all fitted carpets and air conditioning and the low hum of computers. And it's like a local bank or building society, really. And people come in and log on to their computers and stare at the screens all day. as if transfixed. I mean, don't even leave their desks for lunch, usually. Just have a sandwich, a glass of water.
They don't have to leave their desks for research either, because they can now Google, whereas in those days you'd have to run around town to find something out.
Oh, yes, never leave the desk. And then at about 5 o'clock or whatever, 5:30, log off their computer and go straight home. It's not the sort of Fleet Street I grew up with, and which is why I don't work in newspaper offices anymore. I've become a freelancer. I work from home, and I try to recreate the atmosphere of old Fleet Street in my shed in Essex by sitting there in a room knee-deep with bits of paper, chaos, noise, mess everywhere, and I can pretend I'm in the old Daily Express building in about 1935.
I inadvertently interrupted your account of your first newspaper by mentioning facts, and the reason I raise that is because I know you take facts very, very seriously, for someone so opinionated.
Yes, I'm afraid I do. I have a bit of an obsession with fact-checking, as they call it in America. And it's why things take me so long. I think I'm quite a slow writer. And from time to time, editors have said, you know, why don't you write a column for me as well as for them? Or why don't you write this, that and the other for me? And I said, well, they take me a long time to do. Oh, come on, you just dash one off and take you more than an hour. And I said, well, I can't dash things off. The trouble is, I can't do top-of-the-head stuff because I sort of feel that a journalist's duty is to inform as well as entertain or persuade or provoke or whatever, and that actually I quite like people to learn something. Even if I'm writing a column, an apparently opinionated column, I quite like them to go away better informed than they were before they read it, regardless of whether they agree with me. So I like to put that in, and I spend ages pointlessly checking something which will take one sentence in the finished piece. I can spend half a day just checking that one fact.
I've got to ask you about your fact-checking when there was a new pope, because this connects you and I, doesn't it, this little story?
Well, yes, because back in 1978, on the New Statesman, one Tuesday afternoon, I think it was, I was asked by the editor, Bruce Page, to go and write a profile of John Paul II, who had just become pope. The white smoke had just come up from the Vatican chimney. And we went to press an hour or two later, so I didn't have very long to do it. And by chance, I found a Polish emigre in London who was working for the BBC World Service and who had known Karol Wojtyla since they were boys together. So he was full of stuff. And I raced back to the office, wrote it all up and said, those who know him best or who have known him longest say the new pope is burble, burble. And a few weeks later, I got a letter from Australia from someone enclosing a column by Philip Adams, quoting Vatican watcher Francis Ween. This idea that the strength of one article written in an hour or two, I was now a Vatican watcher, like a Kremlinologist. The person who sent me this letter from Australia saying, well, I'm a great fan of Philip Adams' column, and we saw a Ween mentioned in it. And we were very excited because I am called Edwin Ween, and I'm one of many Weens in Australia. And I discovered all these lost relations in Australia entirely thanks to you.
If there are any Weens listening, the programme is Late Night Live on Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and downloadable via MP3 onto your pod. And my guest is the Ween known as Francis. And any Weens listening, don't hesitate to log onto our website and I'll give you all his personal information, his private phone numbers, his mobile, his blood group, because we like to have these little family reunions. Let us now have a reunion with the Enlightenment, because it's taken a hell of a battering. And I have to say, on this program, frequently people come on and hammer away at it, but I sort of like the Enlightenment. And yes. So do you.
Oh, yeah. And actually, I feel more protective of it now than perhaps I did when I started writing the book. It was only while I was writing the book I realised how much I value the Enlightenment legacy and how much I mind the fact that it is being hammered away at and that it's worth defending, the legacy of reason, secularism, scientific empiricism, that sort of thing, which from the 18th
century onwards, and the notion of progress, how does that sit with you?
The notion of progress, the very idea of progress, that whole Enlightenment idea that the world can be improved, now something that appears to have been jettisoned, and actually jettisoned by all sorts of people. I mean, it's very striking. In the book I've written, How Mumbo Jumbo Conquered the World, it starts in 1979. It's, in a sense, a history of the ideas that have been swirling around over this period. And so you have things like the end of history, the clash of civilizations. And it's striking how many of them hold that nothing can be done about it. The end of history, the idea was the world has now reached the end of its political, economic evolution. No progress or improvement is possible. The clash of civilizations, the idea is well, you've got these civilizations, so-called. They're always clashing, always have been, always will be. All you can do is defend your corner and fight off anyone who encroaches on it. But you can't hope for a better world where... I mean, it's all nonsense anyway, because, of course, the real clash is within civilizations, not between them. I mean, each civilization has conservative elements, liberal elements, religious elements, secular elements. I mean, all sorts of different elements. The Oklahoma bomb set off by Timothy McVeigh, if that had been done by someone from one of the other civilizations, no doubt they would say, ah, you see, clash of civilizations. But of course, it was done by a full red blooded American. Mm. These things happen within as well as without.
They're and most just... of the Islamic terrorist attacks are against fellow Islamics.
They are indeed, yes, it's very striking. And actually, also, another peculiarity of it, in Britain in July, we had bombs in London, which were all set off by people who were born in Britain.
Mm. OK, you've chosen 1979 as the turning point for the retreat from enlightenment. And that was, I think, the most shocking thing for me in the book. It seemed a very late date. Why did you choose 79?
Well, you have to start somewhere. I suppose all dates like that are a bit artificial. But I did think it was a significant turning point in modern history and had really set the tone for the next quarter of a century, because you have the Iranian Revolution, the return of the Ayatollah Khomeini, which I would say is the start of the new militant Islamism, the new aggressive Islamist theocratic movement, which now turns up in all sorts of different forms in different parts of the world. And you had the arrival of Margaret Thatcher as Prime Minister in Britain, again with a rather revolutionary mission in mind, a slightly different one. Except the one thing she and the Ayatollah, I think, had in common was a desire to turn the clock back, which is what you're talking about with progress and the Enlightenment, that both these people, on very different missions, hated the 20th century and thought the thing to do is go back to some imagined golden age, in her case, Victorian values, the 19th century, capitalism in the pioneer days when you didn't have any welfare states or any trade unions or any of that nonsense, the Ayatollah wanting to go back about 1,500 years, rather... more impressive ambition in a way. But they did both think the answer to their objections to the world they lived in was to go back, whereas, of course, traditionally, until then, the idea had been, well, if of course the world is imperfect and we don't like this, but progress is possible. We can improve upon it. Whereas for them, no such idea was tenable anymore.
And they also shared a lack of self-doubt and a lack of humour.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because Mrs. Thatcher was always thought to have no sense of humour at all, and I rather went along with this until a few years ago, during the Bosnian War in the mid-90s, when I discovered from a source close to her that Bob Dole, the American politician, was coming to London, and Bob Dole took quite an interventionist line in Bosnia, as did Mrs. Thatcher, and he was coming to London to see John Major, the then Prime Minister, among other things. And Thatcher said to... it's very confusing, all these Doles, because Thatcher's right-hand man was called Lord Pole, Charles Pole. And she said to Charles Pole, I'm going to go and picket number 10 Downing Street tomorrow. That will get me on the news, won't it? And I've done this placard, and it said... because she objected to Helmut Kohl's attitude to Bosnia, the non-interventionist attitude, and so it was going to say, Dole, not Kohl. And given that she had herself endured a coal miners' strike where the famous slogan was coal not dole, Maggie, 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 out, 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 I thought, my God, perhaps she has got a glimmer of a sense of humour, the old girl. And she jolly nearly did it. Charles Pole said, oh, you're joking, Prime Minister, because he still calls her Prime Minister, even though she's not. And she said, no, 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 I think it's very important, those poor people in Bosnia. And this will get it noticed all around the world. Sort of bag lady turning up outside number 10, waving her handmade placard saying, Dole, not curl, as Bob Dole arrived. But anyway, she was eventually talked out of it.
I'm delighted to stand corrected on the question.
The only known joke she's ever made in her life. But
yes, well, let me quote from your book. And incidentally, listener, although it's got this highly amusing title, How Mumbo Jumbo Conquered the World, this is a dead serious book. You fall about laughing on almost every page when it's revealed, for example, that Sherry Blair is even nuttier and new agier than Nancy Reagan, but it is also spine-chilling from cover to cover and deeply depressing in a happy sort of way. Let me quote, the sleep of reason brings forth monsters, and the past two decades have produced monsters galore. Some are manifestly sinister, others seem merely comical, harmless fun, as Nancy Reagan said of her husband's reliance on astrology. However, the proliferation Bunkum and the assault on reason are a menace to civilization, especially as many of the new rationalists hark back to some imagined pre-industrial or even pre-agrarian golden age. Now, okay, we know the identity of some of the manifestly sinister monsters. We've mentioned a couple. Are there others?
Yes, some more sinister than others. I think it's the fact that so many of them have emerged at the same time that makes them particularly alarming. Because you quoted there Nancy Reagan, when it turned out that throughout Ronald Reagan's presidency he wasn't allowed to do anything until Nancy had cleared it with her astrologer. She said, oh, it's harmless pastime, it's harmless fun, millions of people do it. Which is probably true, undoubtedly true, of astrology. Millions of people do read their horoscopes. But the harmless side of it seems harmless in individual cases. If just one person is reading their horoscope, where's the harm in that? Well, actually, it might do them some harm. If the horoscope says you are about to experience a great tragedy, you then walk around in a state of gloom, wondering when something's going to drop on your head. But it's not individual, because these things, I think, are cumulative and contagious. And so when you succumb to one delusion, you're much more susceptible to other ones. And that's what I think has happened over this period.
That was seen demonstrable in the 30s an epidemic. And within the Nazis too, wasn't it? There was a huge amount of this nonsense built into Nazism.
That's absolutely... I'm often reminded of footage of old Nuremberg rallies, actually, when I think about the mumbo-jumbo I'm talking about, particularly eruptions of sentimental or emotional hysteria, mass hysteria. I mean, some, again, may seem harmless, even if a bit alarming to me, like the fact that Britain lost its senses for 2 weeks after Princess Diana died. I mean, the whole country turned into a nation of people ululating and howling
too.
And weeping.
No, this country too, really. And I
Surely
was one
not.
Of the few people that kept saying, this is absolute bullshit, and I've still got a sugar bag of hate mail.
Really? I didn't realise it was as bad as that in Australia as well. We? Well, it was the whole nation of Britain went utterly bonkers. It was very distressing and rather alarming. And with that, I kept thinking, well, this is precisely the kind of mood when a whole nation loses its senses like that, that can be exploited by any passing demagogue who wants to seize on it. And I thought, well, you know, you only have to look at that film of old Nuremberg Grays to see what can happen if people work themselves up into this state. And someone comes along and says, follow me and I shall... See you right.
Francis, one of the things which is very useful about your book, about your columns, is that you don't let the left off lightly, mm-hmm. you know, because many of us on the left are equally guilty of mumbo and or jumbo. And I think that, well, let's deal with one aspect of it. Let's look at postmodernism, because you're really not too happy about that. Is it mumbo or jumbo or both?
I think it's a bit of both, actually. And it is presented as a radical, progressive sort of thing. I mean, most of the postmodernists, and certainly the leaders of it, saw themselves as either Marxists or post-Marxists or radicals of some kind, quite often French, gitan-smoking chaps in berets, as it were, who had been throwing cobblestones in their youth. And yet, actually, the point of postmodernism, its sort of terminus that it reached, was this idea that there's no such thing as reality, that everything is just a theory, everything is a text, nothing has any meaning, nothing has any validity, except everything is equally valid or invalid, all that sort of stuff. And it leads to this terminal relativism, where you don't accept that some things are more plausible than others or truer than others, that even if absolute truth is not achievable in something, that you can get a darn sight closer to the truth with some theories than with others, and actually thereby plays into the hands of all the most Neanderthal and reactionary elements. I mean, like neo-Nazi historians, David Irving, who writes books saying that no Jews were killed at Auschwitz and that sort of thing, of course seized on it, because postmodernist historians, all these people who fancy themselves as radical Marxist historians and postmodernists, argue that there is no such thing as historical truth. There are merely theories and they're all equally likely.
But you would have enjoyed it. You would have enjoyed it for a moment when it was knocking the stuffing out of rather constipated modes of thought.
I enjoyed it when it was structuralism, yeah. In its early days, I quite enjoyed it. It was sort of playful and also useful, just as when it was saying that close textual analysis is profitable, and when you can actually study works in their social context, cultural context, this may give you new insights. I mean, all this is perfectly reasonable and fair. Nothing much against the structuralists. But it didn't stop there. It headed down this absolute dead end, I think.
I think it reached its apotheosis, and I'm almost afraid to say this name because I'll get inundated with cranky emails yet again. the Alan Sokol story. Would you run that past Gladys?
Yes. Well, you better get inundated. I'm worried to hear that. Australia, I was horrified to discover it's been a real education to me this trip. I didn't know that Deepak Chopra was so big in Australia. I didn't realise that there were still quite a few creationists in Australia. Now you tell me that there are lots of postmodernists lurking in Australia as well. It's all very worrying. And there was I thinking, what a lucky country this is. Still, anyway.
That was an ironic title.
Yeah, I know. But Alan Sokol was a New York physics professor and also an old-fashioned New York lefty. Surprises some people to discover that such people exist, but they do. And what he particularly objected to was that postmodernists were using the language of science to give this appearance of scientific method to their witterings. And what he also objected to was that he, as a proper old-fashioned New York radical, thought that for 200 years the left had supported enlightenment against obscurantism, and now it appears to be exactly the other way round with postmodernism. So he played a little practical joke on them, submitted a hoax paper to their journal, Social Text, it's called. And he wrote this paper called Transgressing the Boundaries Towards the Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity. You see, he'd picked up the jargon. He knew what would appeal to them. And he also knew what would flatter them. A genuine physics professor paying tribute to their superior wisdom and saying, well, I'm a mere scientist, but the people who really understand science are people like Lucy Rigari and Jacques Lacan. Lucy Rigari, who has pointed out that E equals MC squared is a sixth equation because it privileges the speed of light against other less masculine speeds. All this sort of rubbish, let alone Jacques Lacan. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this on a radio programme. Perhaps late at night it's all right. Jacques Lacan, who has a long equation involving sort of S over S equals S, where S is the sign and the signifier and the signified, and ends up proving to his own satisfaction that his erect penis is the square root of minus one.
Oh, dear, oh, dear.
Anyway, the Sokol hoax was a great success because they printed this rubbish, this spoof paper of his, and he then exposed his own hoax. And I mean, the paper began by saying,
not his own penis.
He says, we now see hoax. That the laws of physics, or indeed that that the physical world, the natural world, is entirely a social and linguistic construct. It has no actual existence. And when he exposed his hoax, he said, fair enough, if the editors of this journal think that the external world is entirely a social construct or a linguistic construct, they're welcome to try transgressing it from the windows of my apartment on the 23rd floor.
There's a lot of it about, isn't there? Creationism has always had its tentacles, at least in parts of Australia, and there was during the in one government in Queensland, a formal attempt to get it on into the books.
Was this in the Bjelke-Petersen?
The Bjelke-Petersen period. And recently, the Federal Minister for Education has given it a sort of a diagonal nod, suggesting that it's proper that kids be given alternative views. It's an argument, of course, you recognise from other places. It's pretty much an American thing, isn't it? An American pathology. Has it got into the UK?
Well, it is creeping in, I'm sorry to say. I mean, in America, there are lots of creationists. In fact, only last week, when this court case began in Pennsylvania, and there's always something going on along these grounds these days, and there's now a big legal battle in Pennsylvania over whether or not creationism is taught on the biology syllabus. And opinion polls are done, and they usually seem to show that somewhere between 40% and 50%, I mean between 40% and 47%, of Americans believe the world is 5,000 years old, was created by God 5,000 years ago, Garden of Eden, well, 6 days and seventh day rested, and then Garden of Eden. And they believe that to be the actual literal truth. The Book of Genesis is the only biology textbook that people need to study. And it's amazing after all these years. I mean, I think in my book, in my Mumbo Jumbo book, I quote Woodrow Wilson back in the early 20s being asked about organic evolution and saying, well, like all sensible people, I more or less accept that evolutionary theory is the most likely explanation. I'm amazed the question should be raised at this late date, he says. This is in 1922. And here we are in 2005. And
mind you, it's segued into intelligent design now, hasn't it? It's appropriated some of the jargon of science.
Yes. Well, it had to, because the American courts eventually banned creationism in schools when they pointed out it was in breach of the Constitution, the separation of church and state, the ban on religion in schools. So they simply abolished the G word from creationism, and the creationists now push intelligent design in schools, saying, oh, well, there's nothing religious about this, because, look, it doesn't mention Genesis, doesn't mention God, or anything else beginning with G, so we're okay. But of course, it is exactly the same people pushing it, and for exactly the same reasons. And intelligent design, the intelligence there, no doubt about what they have in mind as the intelligence they're talking about that created this this world.
I'm talking to Vatican watcher Francis Ween on LNL, on Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and your pod. And I want to get into the self-help era. But before we do that, let's clarify an issue. What is your own sort of cosmology? What's your own final view of things?
Ooh, I'm a God botherer. My star sign from, isn't it? my own cosmology. No, I'm not a God botherer. No, I'm an atheist. Not even an agnostic. I'm sorry to say. I always feel that agnosticism is for some people. I mean, some people are genuine agnostics, whereas I think for others, they're actually atheists. But it sounds safer to say agnostic.
Hell with Vincent.
Also, there's a bit of bet hedging there because you think, well, that way maybe I'll be let off if I turn out to be wrong. But no, I'm afraid to say I'm a convinced atheist. However, everyone else in my family is a convinced God botherer. I mean, I come from a long line of Church of England vicars and lay readers and brides of Christ, as it were. And I did once in my teens have a very brief period as a Jesus freak. It lasted for about a week and a half. Where I was swept up in the summer holidays, and I could see how people I now can remember.
Was it sexually kindled in any way?
It certainly was. Exactly, yes.
Precisely. Therefore forgivable.
I was at home during a very boring, long holidays, and I didn't know anyone at home who lived near me because I went to a boarding school miles away. And sitting there, my parents said that some other people who lived nearby, their daughter was going to this festival for Jesus in London, going up every day. And I thought, well, it sounds interesting, better than nothing. And also, she sounds rather nice. So up I went every day for a week, and we'd spend the morning in a church in South London being given our briefing, as it were. And then we would go out on the London Underground in the afternoon armed with lots of stickers saying, Jesus loves you, and going up to policemen and other people like that saying, are you saved? Isn't it about time? I'm amazed they didn't arrest us or clip our ears, at least, on the spot. And then in the evening, as our reward for going around evangelising, we were treated to a concert every night with Cliff Richard.
Oh, my God.
That's how bad it was. But anyway, because I fancied this girl, but also because I got swept up in it, because I was sort of sitting there bored and lonely in the holidays, and suddenly there was this vast collective experience. There were hundreds of us, thousands of us, I imagine, who were swept up in this thing together. And I could see the excitement and the enthusiasm as other people egg you on. And I'm ashamed to say that I can actually vividly remember going around London accosting complete strangers on the Underground and saying, God loves you, are you saved? And then sticking stickers on their jacket, whether they liked it or not.
Has there been a moment in your political trajectory when you've also wandered off the path?
Well, I've never voted Conservative, if that's what you mean. There are limits. I think the day that comes will be a very worrying day. Hasn't happened yet.
Right. In parenthesis, though, I mentioned that you and Christopher Hitchens were at New Statesman together I think in one of its golden ages, actually. And I've kept every New Statesman since I was about 12. Don't always read them, but I like to have them. You know, just the laying on of hands, I find, is nourishing.
You don't agree with that? There's a wonderful Max Harris poem called On Throwing a Copy of the New Statesman into, I forget what.
So there is, I've forgotten.
Into the river in a rage. And it's very funny as he chucks the New Statesman into the river. Max Harris says, there goes Kingsley Martin with his wretched Fabian gentility. And I've been trying to track it down, and luckily I found a bookshop in Sydney which has a second-hand copy of Max Harris's selected poems, so I'm just hoping it's in that. I'm going to find out later today, I think.
Oh, suddenly memories of Max come rushing back. Max with his silver-headed walking stick. Now, OK. Let's get on to this old snake oil and new bottles part. Let's get on to this sudden rush of gurus. And which, I mean, in a way it was sort of funny, but it was also profoundly sad. How do you account for that? How do you account for the fact that the Western world suddenly needed not so much Thatcher as McLean, not so much Margaret as Shirley?
Yes, gosh, I was wondering who McLean was until you came up with the first name. I was thinking of Burgess and McLean, the old spy.
Sorry.
That McLean. Or Don McLean, who wrote American Pie. Well, it is odd, because there definitely has been a proliferation of gurus, and I'm not sure that I have a very clear or certain answer, but I have a few tentative theories, because after all, there's some... The postmodernists always point out, it's all just theories, isn't it? But actually, in this case, I mean, they are merely theories. I make no greater claim for them. But one is, I think, that as people become, if you like, more atomised, you know, that whole idea that, I don't know if it's to do with moving out to the suburbs or what it is, but certainly it's not entirely true, but there was a book called Bowling Alone years ago, suggesting that people are involved in fewer collective or community things, as they no longer belong to political parties or attend so many meetings or belong to other things, that they're slightly more atomised, and that therefore perhaps there is that hole in their life which is filled by gurus of some kind, that the collective experience you once possibly got at a trade union meeting can now be achieved by going to your local self-help group meeting, say. So it may be a bit of that. I think it may also be that people feel insecure, uncertain about what the future holds for them because of all the changes in this period, the extraordinary upheavals that the internet revolution and things like that have brought about. This sense that, I don't know, when I was a child, all people of my parents' generation seemed to stay in the same jobs, but the same companies or corporations or institutions pretty well all their working lives. That was the norm. So they knew where they were going to be in 30 years' time. Whereas now, I know scarcely anyone who expects to be working for the same institution in even 10 years' time.
Yes, atomising is an interesting way of expressing it. I was thinking about my dear old grandfather, who was a simple farmer who raised me. He had one personality, and that sounds pretty obvious, but he knew who he was, and he was as rooted in the earth as the plants he grew. And as I grew up, I started to realise that I was surrounded by people who were suffering from multiple personality disorder. The personality became like a little window in front of you that you put things in. And most of us have half a dozen operational personalities.
Yes.
As we sort of negotiate the maelstrom of what life has become.
Well, I think it's also, yes, I think that's a very good, interesting point, because there is this terrible dead end, which nevertheless became very popular, of identity politics over the last 25 years or so, or rather more than that now, I suppose, from the 60s and 70s onwards. Increasingly, there was this sense of identity politics that, you know, your politics are culturally determined. You are what your identity is what you were given. I mean, it's an extraordinary reactionary idea and culminates logically in things like the fatwa being introduced against Salman Rushdie because the Ayatollah Khomeini said he's a Muslim, therefore, his parents are Muslim, therefore he's an apostate, therefore it's blasphemy and he can have a fatwa. I mean, if he hadn't had Muslim ancestors, no fatwa could have really been issued against him for blasphemy in that way. And it is a very reactionary thing, but the left adopted this as a progressive thing, you know, that whatever the identity might be, whether it was black or lesbian or anything, that was your identity, and that fixed your political allegiances and outlooks on things. And of course, if you go down that road of identity politics, then self-examination becomes very important to check exactly what your identity is. Are you, you know, Asian, gay, whatnot? Because you have to have all these things to fill in the boxes to decide.
But you can tick a lot of boxes these days.
You can, yes, it's a bit easier these days. But of course, the more of that sort of self-examination you do, then there is a slight tendency towards narcissism, I think, after all, or at least utter self-absorption. I mean, I think an awful lot of, there's nothing wrong with examining oneself, but I think it developed navel-gazing to a new degree, a lot of this self-help stuff. And it encouraged it. It said, look in on yourself, aren't you wonderful? And suggested that was the highest form of being, gazing at your own navel and ignoring the rest of the world, which may be why the rest of the world is in such a mess, because people are so busy sitting there in the lotus position, gazing at their navels.
I can't remember his name. Was it Hillman, who was a big-time American therapist? He used to come on the program quite often. And he wrote a book with one of these immense American titles, in fact, even longer than your title, which was, we've had 30 years of therapy, why aren't we getting better? Or words to that effect. And, of course, the opposite is true. Far from getting better, people seem to be more and more atomised.
Yes.
There are now pills for it.
I mean, actually, I thought this even with what appears to be a collective experience, like the mass emoting after the death of Princess Diana, it was after a while I realised that this was probably narcissistic rather than collective, because people were beating their breasts and howling and basically saying, look at me, I'm grieving even more ostentatiously than you are, even more extravagantly. So even that, what appeared to be a substitute for other older forms of collective experience, actually turned out to be just another form of narcissism.
One of the people who will almost certainly be listening to this discussion is my oldest friend, Barry Jones, who was our Minister for Science. And Barry would love, in fact, I know he does, he loves everything you say in this book and would agree with it wholeheartedly. And yet Barry is, well, not so much He's not a name brand Christian anymore. He seems to have given that up, although he's had his dalliances with Methodism. But Barry lives in two worlds. He lives in the world of science, the world of the Enlightenment, but he also is absolutely swept up in the world of Christian theology. And when I sort of say to him, how can this happen? He sort of says, well, you know, there are two hemispheres of my brain and you know, they're in different parts. Well, I can sort of accept that. And you see it, say, in your account of Sherry Blair. Mm. Now, on one hand, here's a woman who's an accomplished lawyer, and on the other, she's nuttier, more New Agey than Nancy Reagan on a bad day.
Oh, yeah, nuttier than a bag of macadamias. She's extraordinary. And as you were saying, I mean, it goes back to Isaac Newton, another one, a brilliant scientist.
Totally.
And totally besotted by things like alchemy, an absolute sucker for any of these things. So there is a long tradition of people, as you say, who seem to able to do both these things in their brain simultaneously. There's one bit of their brain which is the successful barrister and indeed judge now, Cherie Blair, and the other part, which is... It's also very strong. I think she's a very revealing figure, emblematic in a way, because she's apparently a devout Catholic, a very seriously devout Catholic. And traditionally, the Catholic Church has taken rather a dim view of astrology and all sorts of other mumbo-jumbo-y things that, you know, they like to cling to their own mumbo-jumbo rather than anyone else's. And yet Cherie is also happily playing around with feng shui, Ayurvedic medicine, I expect chakra balancing is in there, something. I mean, you name it, she's done it. She's
tried running up and down a beach covered in mud with
her
husband.
Oh, howling, yes. That was a horrible experience. When she and her husband, I'm sorry to say, the British Prime Minister, no less, Tony Blair, standing there almost naked except for his swimming trunks on a beach in Mexico, covered in mud and melon and papaya, howling and screaming to signify the pain of rebirth, and then rushing down to the sea to wash it all off. But just before he...
I recommend this to our Prime Minister and his good lady. I think this is what they need.
You think Mr Howard needs a bit of melon juice smeared over him? A bit of howling.
Well, yes.
But the most successful and popular leaders increasingly do, certainly in our part of the world, and in America even more so, exactly. The two presidents in the last, say, 30 or 40 years, who have been by far the most successful, Reagan and Clinton, both two-term presidents who, at the end of their second term, would undoubtedly have won a third term had they been allowed to stand again. I think very striking that Reagan, as I mentioned earlier, was at the mercy of his wife's astrologer. Clinton was also a sucker for gurus of every kind and invited
as
them
she
to
was,
Camp David.
As
and Hillary,
was,
even yeah. more so. Hillary, in fact...
Spoke to the dead.
She spoke to Eleanor Roosevelt and Mahatma Gandhi for their spirits, and she had all these sacred mystics and sacred psychologists on the strength while Bill was chatting to his management gurus, who are just another form of guru, all these chaps who write books called Awaken the Giant Within, The Seven Secrets of Highly Effective People, all that sort of rubbish. So they were suckers for it, and yet they were undoubtedly very successful and popular politicians, which suggests that they were probably in tune with a large part of their electorate, that, by and large, most voters now do go for this stuff and elect politicians, certainly in America, and actually to a degree in Britain now, because Tony and Cherie, I'm afraid, are like that, and he's the most successful Labour leader we've ever had. He just won a third term.
The giant within this programme. Late Night Live, Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web and your iPod. The giant within it is Francis Wheen. I was distracted by your brilliance.
I was wondering why you were throwing your barrow across the floor.
Let's go back to the New Statesman and you and Christopher. Now, I have the most immense affection and admiration for Christopher, except on certain political matters of the moment. You're still friends, aren't you and Chris?
Christopher Hitchens, rather. Mm. Yes. In fact, I saw him. He was over in London a month or two ago and I had to do a double act with him. Well, actually, with Christopher, you can't really do a double act. So it turned out my function was just to introduce him and then sit back as he held forth for about an hour and managed to antagonise the entire audience, I think. And
yet, he's enjoying that, though.
Oh, he loves it. Oh, yes. Go 15 rounds with him and then he'll say, well, it's a bit early. Couldn't we have another 15 rounds? Mm. Never happier. I find it exhausting. Whenever I go to Washington, D.C., I will stay with him. And it takes me about a month to recover because I fly in and it's not just the jet lag, but he says, right, I think it's the cocktail hour now. In fact, it's about breakfast time. And off we go. And it's then one thing after another. It's a bar, a restaurant, a party. And next thing I know, it's 4 a.m. and we're sitting there and yet another bottle of whiskey is being opened. He says, and another thing, before he gets into a further complicated argument about the Armenian massacres or about goodness knows what. And eventually I stagger off to sleep in his spare room and then I'm woken, usually about 7 a.m, by the sound of Christopher sitting there in his dressing gown writing 4,000 words for the Atlantic Monthly or the New York Review of Books before breakfast. He has the constitution of an ox, and I find it very hard to keep up with him these days.
Yes, I watched him demolish 1.5 bottles of Johnny Walker Black Label on a trip to Sydney, and I would have been unconscious, but he was perfectly functioning. How do you feel about his line on Iraq?
Well, I see his point. I don't share his tone or his, I think, intolerance and incomprehension of anyone who could possibly be against the war on Iraq. It seems to me there are perfectly good arguments to be made against the war, as there were for it. I mean, I think there was a legitimate argument to be made for intervention in Iraq, just as there was against. The problem was there wasn't actually much of a debate. There was a lot of screaming that went on, but it wasn't actually argued in any civilised way. And I think Christopher slightly harms his own case by the way in which he delivers it. He suggests that no one but an imbecile, and a wicked imbecile at that, could possibly disapprove of any aspect of the war in Iraq, which is really not, I think, very helpful in terms of winning round doubters or converting. In fact, I know several people, left-wing, liberal-type people, who on balance decided after a certain amount of agonising that they probably were in favour of it. This was at the time, in 2003, and then were put off by Christopher's support, even though he was by then, as it were, on their side. I know several of them who said, why does he have to sound so absolutely certain about everything? Doesn't he see that there might be room for some bit of agonising on this question? You know, there might be doubts and worries and so forth. He's so sublimely confident of it all. But I'm afraid that is his nature, Christopher. He's sublimely confident in everything he does, and that's part of his charm.
But, of course, if all he'd ever done was write that stunning book on Kissinger, or the naughty book on
Mother Teresa.
On Mother Teresa, he would have more absolutely justified his that wonderful essay, I think it was in the TLS, on the novels of Anthony Powell, which I thought was just staggeringly good.
Well, that's in his last collection of book reviews and essays. Actually, it's not his last collection now, it's his last but one, I think. Unacknowledged Legislation. There's a more recent one called Love, Poverty and War.
Mm.
And I think it's in the first, but it might be in the other. Anthony Powell. He writes brilliantly about books. If you don't get the Atlantic Monthly, you should certainly look at their website, because you can read most of it online. And every month there's a huge long piece by Christopher. One month it might be Christopher Hitchens on Jorge Luis Borges. The next month it's Hitchens on Evelyn Waugh. Then it'll be somebody else completely, James Joyce or Proust. And he's wonderful. He's brilliant on all that.
You talk about the New Age amusingly. And we've discussed the problems of postmodernism, but you're also into voodoo economics. You're pretty tough on the flat earthers, aren't you?
Yes, the Laffer curvers. Does anyone still remember the Laffer curve? It's one of those slightly forgotten things, a bit like the third way. No one.
The bell curve's back. That fellow's come back with a new book.
He's got, yes, I see. Having done a book saying that black people are
genetically
stupider than white people, he's now done one saying women are naturally inferior to men. He said, you say what you like about Charles Murray. He doesn't duck a fight, does he? God, he's a brave man. But anyway, he'll get to the neck as well he deserves to, especially as the bell curve was, I thought, an utterly fraudulent piece of work, collapsed.
But there is a bell curve application, isn't there, to economics, and you're just as cranky about that.
Oh, yes, yes. And actually, the person who coined the phrase voodoo economics to describe Reaganomics was actually President George Bush.
Senior.
Yeah. It was in the primaries in 1980 when he was running against candidate Reagan that he derided Reagan and said all he's spouting is voodoo economics. And he was quite right about it, but of course shortly afterwards he became the running mate, so we never heard any more from him about the voodoo-ness of...
But it's now the prevailing view, even among Social Democrat parties. If you elect a Labour government, you get the same sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, that's... I mean, when I talk about how it's conquered the world, how Mumbo Jumbo's conquered the world, I mean, I really do think it's the case with Thatcherism that it became the received wisdom, and everyone, from Tony Blair to whoever, all over the place, it's been adopted as... because Thatcher used to say, there is no alternative. Yet again, it brings us this whole thing of the determinism of the end of history and the clash of civilization. There is no alternative. That was Thatcher's line. You may not like it, but this is how it has to be. Deregulation, privatization, smash the unions and so on. And it's now being applied by people like the IMF all over the globe. I mean, even the people who've done it voluntarily, like various social democratic parties and labour parties, sometimes it's voluntarily, but also because they fear that if they don't, perhaps then they'll be bullied into it in other countries which didn't wish to adopt this, they had no choice because the IMF chaps turn up and say, it's one size fits all, isn't it? So wherever you go, you wave your briefcase from the International Monetary Fund and say, right, we have to liberalise your capital controls and do all these other things, regardless of what the country is and what state its economy is in. And it does cause disaster. We saw in Russia, actually, with the fall of the Soviet Union, there were these men from Harvard Business School who moved in under Yeltsin and who basically said that the economy had to be transformed overnight, privatise everything in 5 seconds flat. And it's a huge place like Russia. The shocks in the system in what they proposed meant that you then, by 1997-98, had this meltdown, not surprisingly. Because I had a long chat a couple of years ago with Anatoly Chubais, who was responsible for all those privatisations and basically allowing these extremely dodgy moguls to become billionaires overnight. And I said, well, do you not feel this is a rather corrupt process, that you basically gave away all these things to a few cronies for tuppence halfpenny and they're now worth billions of pounds, and the state oil companies and other state companies, state energy and gas companies? And he said, yes, yes, well, I agree, it wasn't very well organised, it was entirely corrupt, but we had to do it in no time at all because there was a presidential election coming up and we were afraid that the old communists, the ex-communists, were going to win. I remember the days of Gennady Gerasimov and people like that. And we thought Yeltsin would lose, the communists will get back in and it'll be back to the days of the Soviet Union. So we had a scorched earth policy. I thought, we'll sell off absolutely everything, and then even if they win, it'll be too late for them to renationalise it. So I sold it all off for a couple of rubles to a few cronies who we happen to know. It was very badly organised and disgraceful, but it was worth it for political reasons. But even he accepted that it was not exactly a model of how to carry on. But that was certainly encouraged by this idea of all these Thatcherite disciples who are now pests who turn up in any city in the world and say, it worked for Mrs. Thatcher.
Francis, here we are, a couple of ageing groupies of the Enlightenment, a couple of people still with at least one foot in the world of what's left of the left. How can we cope? What can we usefully do at a time when various fundamentalisms, from economic fundamentalism, Christian fundamentalism in the US, etc., is so overwhelmingly successful?
Well, what do we do? I think one thing we can do is speak up for it and defend it vigorously and publicly, because there are quite a lot of people who, you know, who adhere to Enlightenment values and cherish the Enlightenment legacy, but who in recent years have been a bit timid about defending it in public, a bit wary of it, because the Enlightenment has got this bad reputation for universalism. You know, the idea that, I mean, personally, I think universalism in some respects is not a bad thing. I mean, lots of people from the left now denounce the Enlightenment, say it's orientalist, isn't it? Because it tries to impose these universal values. And I actually think that certain things, you know, such as liberty and civil rights and so forth, are, or at least ought to be, the birthright of any human being. And if you believe that, then you adhere to things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The whole implication of things like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is that there is a certain basic minimum that one can aspire to that can be applied all over the world without being accused of imposing our culture on yours. I mean, it's this awful cultural relativism that assumes that, I mean, the arguments about democracy, for example, I mean, we're having it now over the arguments about democracy in the Arab world. Oh, well, no, the Arabs, they don't want democracy, and no, it wouldn't suit them at all. And actually, progressives who say this now, echoing all the old racists who over the generations said, oh, no, the Indians can't be allowed to govern themselves and have a democracy. Oh, no, they're not up to the job. This is normally, traditionally, the arguments of the most reactionary people, whereas now it's the groovy cultural relativists who say, oh, well, it's not for us to say whether it would be a good thing or a bad thing if the Arab world had democracy, even though actually people in the Arab world would rather like the chance to vote or at least to influence their governments in some way. But, oh, no, we know better what's good for them. So actually it's in the name of being non-judgmental. It's actually condemning these people to live under the most appalling tyrannies.
You told us what the world of journalism was like when you began your career as an office boy on The Guardian in 1974.
Yes.
What do you make of newspapers now in 2005?
What, Australian newspapers?
No, the broadsheet newspaper.
Oh, the broadsheet. Well, we scarcely have any left in Britain now. They've all gone tabloid. The broadsheets are almost all. I think there's one.
I use the term metaphorically rather than physically.
There's now, I think, only one daily national broadsheet left: the Daily Telegraph. All the others, the Times, the Guardian, the Independent, have gone tabloid or Le Monde sized, which is a bit annoying for me because about 2 years ago, I was so fed up with the state of journalism in Britain that I decided to set up a new national daily newspaper called The World. Because it seemed to me that as things like the Times had moved down market or stampeded down market towards the middle market, which is all fine and dandy if they think that's where the readers are who want pages of celebrity gossip and showbusy stuff and reality TV dressed up as news stories, that's fine. But I thought there are at least some readers like me who've been left a bit high and dry. So I was going to set up this paper, which would aim to sell about 100,000 copies a day, and we started trying to raise money. And in fact, an Australian then came on board last year, Eric Beecher, from Melbourne, former editor of the Herald, who now runs crikey.com, among other things. Anyway, old Eric got very excited and said it was good and he was going to invest in it. He got very actively involved. And we went on the way, well, more than halfway towards raising the money, when unfortunately all the national papers and all the broadsheets in Britain suddenly went tabloid. And one of our things was we were going to be a Le Monde-sized paper, sort of halfway between a broadsheet and a tabloid. The Guardian has basically nicked our dummy, I'm sorry to say. I made the mistake of discussing it with the editor of The Guardian, and about 3 weeks ago, The Guardian relaunched itself as an exact replica of what we were planning to do. So I think this could cause problems for our attempts to launch our own rival paper, but maybe it's unnecessary now.
Would you have got distribution or would you have been squeezed, do you think?
No, I think we would have been distributed. I mean, although I'm grumbling about it, I mean, one of the joys of Britain is that there is an extraordinary multiplicity of national daily newspapers. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
We're here, there's only a couple of people to work for or be sacked by.
Well, exactly. I mean, there are lots of cities here which are one newspaper towns. If you go somewhere like Brisbane, say, you know, there's the Courier Mail and that's it. Which is extraordinary. And the same in America, has to be said. I mean, the United States, lots of places are effectively one newspaper town.
Does it matter in a world where less and less
people read them? I think it matters a lot, especially with concentration of ownership. I think if you have one or two owners owning most of the papers, I mean, it's happened in Britain with local papers. Local newspapers have almost all been swallowed up by one or other of a couple of large groups, and most towns are one local paper town. But luckily, we do have other things like the national press. But yeah, of course it matters, because if you have some vast media conglomerate, I mean, we all end up working for Rupert Murdoch sooner or later in our lives if we work in the media, because it's very hard to avoid him. But it doesn't mean that he should necessarily be allowed to control every single media outlet and newspaper and TV station. I don't think that's healthy at all, because he has certain vested interests which are quite awkward to cover in anything owned by him. Though, mark you, my book, How Mambo Jumbo Cooked the World, is actually published by HarperCollins, which is owned by that nice Mr. Murdoch, and yet it includes some rather disobliging remarks about him, so it shows what a tolerant genius
he doesn't
he is,
seem to
really.
Mind. You can slip
water
him
off a duck's back. You can call him any name you like, Harry.
Yeah.
He never grumbles, does he?
Francis, I can't tell you what a delight it is to meet you after all these years. And the book is a short history of modern delusions. There's hardly one that's been left out, I don't think. No, I think they're all there. We didn't get on to the notion of catastrophe. That's we could spend an hour talking about that phenomenon, which, of course, got very intense as the end of the century and the last millennium rapidly approach. But you've got to go out and buy the book, listener. Dear Gladys, get half a dozen Christmas presents, Father's Day, Mother's Day, birthday presents for your children. It's the most useful text. The most useful text. OK, well, you and I are going to go and play cricket now, aren't we? So,
I thought you weren't interested in such matters.
No, well,
I want to learn. You can't pretend you're not interested. I saw a piece by you only the other day pointing out that it's clearly biblical in origin. And that,
So the Da Vinci Cricket Code.
The Da Vinci Cricket Code.
Yes, well, that's perfectly true. Francis, thanks, mate. It's been a delight.
Well, thank you, too. Very kind of you to have me on.
That's it for another week of LNL, and that's it from me for the year. Norman Swan will be sitting in this chair for the next 3 weeks, so if you're going to have a heart attack, now's the time to have it, because Norman will rush over with the paddle pops and do unto you what he used to do to Robin Williams. And then our summer season begins, and I'll be back for that. Thank you, team. Thank you. Sasha Fegan, Annabelle Quince, Chris Short, Paulie Pies Goff, executive producer Chris Bullock, and thank you, dear Gladys, for your company all this year. Much, much appreciated by this ageing and decrepit broadcaster. Thank you.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs broadcast on more than 260 transmitters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Live streaming on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.